I'm Colin McEnroe. This is Where We Live, in a simple twist of fate, to quote Bob Dylan. John Dankosky is in Washington, D.C., and President Obama is making his way towards Connecticut. They are trading places for the day, and I guess I'm trading places with John, too. I noticed we just got some students who've just been ushered into the control room. Are you explaining to them that the person hosting the show doesn't know what he's doing, and this is not the right way to host the show, and all that kind of stuff? So you really have to come back on another day when John is actually here. However, I think we do have an exciting show for you today. Tom Dutchick's with me here in studio. He is the editor of ctcapitalreport.com, which is pretty much the first site everybody opens to in Connecticut if they're interested in politics and government. It's the aggregation site where everything shows up. And joining us by phone, just a second, Rennie Fulco, associate professor and director of the public policy and law program at Trinity College. Obviously, President Obama coming to the state. The state is one of the big stories of the day. Excuse me. And we'll also be talking about a Quinnipiac poll that shows a very close race between Tom Foley and Governor Malloy. So, Tom Dutchick, any thoughts on why President Obama would pick the state of Connecticut? I mean, you know, most of the appearances he'll be making in between now and November will be about helping some embattled U.S. senator, shoring up his margins in Congress as well as he can. Obviously, we do have a competitive governor's race. We know exactly how competitive it is, according to the Q poll. But so why would President Obama come here? Any theories on this?
Yeah, I think there's a lot of discussion going on among the political people in the state of Connecticut. You know, and it got started last week when he got into that hookup with Bobby Jindal down there on the White House lawn. And many people think this is kind of an attaboy governor. You know, as you know, with the president of the United States, he can pick and choose exactly where he wants to go. And so I think he's chosen Connecticut for a reason. It's pretty close. They have a friend as governor. Now, the other flip side is a lot of the second gunman theorists come out and say, well, Governor Malloy is looking for a Washington job, which, of course, a lot of people don't think that's the case. But there's a lot of these you know, weaving storylines that are going on right now, including that's the support in this state for the minimum wage. We saw in New London, the mayor of New London raised the minimum wage to $10.10 already. So I think there's a lot of traction here.
I mean, just to back to that second gunman theory, because I love second gunman theories, it's probably not true in a really specific sense, although I would – you know, there are two kinds of politicians. One of them is the kind of person who automatically, when things are over, when his political fortunes wane – he has a place to go. He knows exactly where he's going to go. And so, I mean, for example, if Tom Foley loses another gubernatorial election, he's got a boat that he can get on and he's got a life that he can go back to. Dan Malloy really does have to look to the future a little bit. I mean, my guess is he doesn't want to go back to practicing law. So, I mean, even though he might not be interested in a specific job in Washington in any particular administration, he may be interested in positioning himself and at least getting a certain level of attention from Washington people for some day down the road when one way or another he's not governor of Connecticut.
Yeah, I think certainly it is not this cycle. I think this governor certainly enjoys doing what he's doing for the state of Connecticut. It's a lifelong ambition for him. He enjoys the trappings of the office. And I don't think he's going anywhere. But I do believe that he's a formidable politician, a formidable opponent to any Republican in there. I think he stays up at night staring at the ceiling going, I can't lose this race. And I think that drives him.
Before I bring Rennie into this conversation, I want to let you know that we'd love to hear from you today, too. If you have your own theories or your own reactions, excuse me, to the visit of Governor Malloy to New Britain, 860-275-7266. That's 860-275-7266. Feel free to call in. We'll be talking a little bit more about the Quinnipiac poll in the second segment. We'd also love to hear from you about that, how you think the race is shaping up. But we're starting here with minimum wage and a presidential visit. We'd love to hear your views. Again, 860-275-7266. Rennie Fulco, I'll ask you a question that's right in your wheelhouse, as they say. You know, one thought that I had looking at the sort of staging, the dramaturgy of today's event in New Britain, you've got the president who will be surrounded by not just Daniel P. Malloy, but also a bunch of other northeastern governors. Mm-hmm. He's heading into an election, a midterm election, where, in fact, most of the news he's going to get is probably going to be kind of bad. Things are not going to get better in the House of Representatives, and things may get worse in the Senate. One way you can govern down the stretch, if you don't have the margins in Congress you need to pass anything, is in collaboration with governors, right? There are things that a president can do simply by talking to like-minded governors around the country.
Yes, and I think that's absolutely true. And I think, you know, Connecticut is a friendly place to come to talk about the minimum wage, right? I mean, the Northeast in general, but certainly Connecticut. And I think that the Democrats are making an effort to be united around this issue, which is a popular issue not only here but in many, many other places. And given how little, I think, is getting done in Congress, at least I think Democratic strategists think that this is a way maybe to move something forward. And you know, I know you're not going to talk about the poll right this minute, but I would simply say, you know, I think Obama's, you know, kind of lousy approval rating in Connecticut is in part due to the fact that, you know, so little has gotten done. There, you know, there's not much to talk about. There's not much to be pleased about.
Well, yeah, and I think, you know, it's sort of like the story of the guy who's down on his hands and knees looking for his contact lens, and somebody says, well, where did it fall out? And he says, about 20 feet away, and the person says, well, why are you looking here? And he goes, the light's better here. Well, the light's better around the minimum wage, right? This is actually something that tests pretty well. Tom Dudzik, I think another thing that he's doing here is going to a place where he's going to get applause. He's going to a place where, in fact, this is a palpable and feasible thing to talk about.
Now, if you look at the recent polling, we'll get into the crosstabs, as they say, a little later on the program. Here's a president that won the state when he first was elected by 22% of the vote. Last time he ran, he won by 18% of the vote. Now 51% of the state disapproves of him. So I'm sure he'll have some fawning people up there kind of applauding his lines. And certainly the kids, the venue they chose was a good one. But this is an issue that the Democrats try to roll out in certain ways every cycle. Remember the Occupy Wall Street movement? We were talking about that and people camping. That's another wedge issue, which kind of says, rich guys are making money, I'm not making money, where's mine? And I think now, as we look towards the 2014 cycle, it's those same issues, those economic, those pocketbook issues, saying the Republicans don't want this, we want this, shame on them.
Yeah, and I think, you know, what's interesting particularly about the minimum wage is that it polls well in places you don't expect it will. In other words, I'm not surprised it polls well in New England, but I am surprised at some of the other places where it's been polling well, and I think that that's why the Democrats really want to move on this one.
But here's what I found fascinating. You know, and I get a chance to listen to a lot of politicians and putting together clips for my program on Sunday on Fox Connecticut. A little shameless plug there, Colin.
And we noticed.
So what I did is I listened to Malloy's messaging right after his State of the State as he talked about minimum wage. And the words he used was families. Let's raise families up. Families, family. And I cut these clips together, about 20 of them together, to show his messaging of families. Then I go to the White House event last week. His messaging has changed. It's all about women. Raise women up. Women need to make more money. Women, women, women. So he got the memo. He got the focus groups. He got the polling. The issue is women's issue is as it relates to minimum wage in the economy.
And I think it's worth noting that President Obama and Governor Malloy are headed in two very different directions. I mean, not policy-wise, but just in terms of their overall futures. President Obama is, in fact, trying to govern here as a lame duck. He's trying to create some kind of legacy. Governor Dan Malloy, obviously, is heading straight into what will probably be a fairly tough election. And I do think, Renee Fulco, that the word inequality, I think, is something that you'll hear President Obama say more and more. That I think inequality is something that does resonate in this country. I think you can say it without touching that class war tripwire. And there are limited things. Sort of going back to the first question I asked you, there are limited things that he can do. I mean, the earned income tax credit is a great way to address inequality. It's a great way to help the working poor. But you've got to get any kind of increase in that through Congress, which is going to be very difficult to do.
Right. And that's really the whole point here, right? The only things he can do are things that don't require congressional action. There is paralysis in Washington. And there's, you know, we've had paralysis for some time. And I guess you can't really blame the guy on that level, that if you can't get anything done through, you know, in cooperation with the legislative branch, you've got to use other means.
Let me grab a call here from Derek on his cell phone, Colin from Windsor. Hi, Derek.
Colin McEnroe, how are you? Great show, man. I just have a comment because I'm hearing polls low on the president's end, and probably rightfully so, because he's not getting a lot of support from the Republican, and everyone knows that. And the thing that I want to point out, that we always got to remember when this guy went into office, where he took the country and where it is today. And most of what he got done is single-handed, and he should be applauded for that.
So, and what you're saying basically is you don't, when you say single-handed, you mean against the fierce opposition from the other party in Congress?
Yes, because from day one they said that they were not going to support this president, and they're still doing that. They're not supporting him. If this president had full support from the Congress, believe me, this country would be at a better place today. So we all got to remember that.
All right. Thanks for your call, Derek. You know, it's a funny thing, Tom Dudchick. One of the things that it's an impossible thing to assess, but certainly having covered a bunch of presidential visits over the course of decades now, you can kind of suss out the excitement level. You can kind of see how the media plays it. There's something a little muted about this whole
thing. And I was talking about this with friends yesterday, and they peaked too early this day. You know, 10, 15 years ago, it would have been like 2 weeks of the news cycle. But with Twitter and Facebook and the instant news, they dropped it last week. Malloy did it on Twitter. By the weekend, it was, like, at least on my site, on the bottom of the page. And so they have a hard time keeping the balloons inflated for the balloon drop and the confetti drop, with 5 days.
Our number, by the way, 860-275-7266. 860-275-7266. Randy Fulco, I don't mean to put you on the spot, but as you look at the final 2 years of President Obama's presidency, the 2 years that will follow this November election, what kinds of issues do you see him able, in the teeth of resistance in Congress, to be able to talk about and move on effectively? I mean, he really is now starting to enter the period of time when presidents think about legacies, how they want to be remembered. He's got health care, which is going to be a very mixed bag for him. What do you see him pursuing in the final years?
Well, I think it was interesting. I think he will have, this effort for young black men. Mm-hmm. I think that that's something that he's going to pursue now and possibly when he's done. But I think he will work on issues related to inequality. I think that's something he actually, feels strongly about and has some ability to affect outside of congressional action. I mean, I think that's really where you have to look. You've got to look at where are the places where a president can actually do something that will be effective that doesn't require congressional action. And, from my perspective, I think that's we're in a pretty sorry state if that's what we're talking about. But I do think that's where we are.
You know, Tom Dudchick, you were talking just before about the rollout and the, as they say, optics of all this. But one interesting little piece of optics that came up this morning that's on your site on CT Capital Report is that the mayor of New Britain, who is a young Republican mayor, has tweeted that she wants to get a selfie with President Obama. I don't know whether that's serious or not, and whether it maybe just sort of suggests that Aaron Stewart is a different kind of Republican.
Well, I think we have entered a new era in gravitas when it comes to our politicians. When members of the UConn women's basketball team are putting bunny ears behind the president of the United States, and young mayors of New Britain want selfies. And she did get a lot of criticism among her Facebook followers as a Republican, a lot of pushback for actually even being with the president, because the president stands for a lot of things that the rank and file Republicans in this state and in New Britain don't agree with.
But see, I think she's crazy like a fox, because in fact, Aaron Stewart's an interesting case. Her generation doesn't necessarily embrace a lot of the sort of hardcore Republican social values, and if you look even at sort of her rise and look at her social media presence, one of the things you see are people who know this young woman. What is she, 26?
Yeah.
I don't know what that is. You see this young woman, she's maybe 26 years old. She's got a lot of friends who knew her in college or whatever, who are not only surprised to find out that she was running for mayor, they're surprised to find out that she's a Republican. They maybe had never guessed that. And in fact, she needs to be a kind of different kind of Republican if she's going to speak to that generation, those millennials
right,
who have not necessarily bought into standard Republican messaging. She needs to do things that an old Republican hand would tell her not to do, including get a selfie with the president.
Right. And plus, in this generation of politics, listen, even if you don't like the Rolling Stones and Mick Jagger's up there on stage and you get to hang with Mick, you're hanging with Mick. It's as simple as that.
Yeah. And, obviously, Randy, you teach a lot of millennials. I assume that kind of rings true for you, too.
Yeah. Yeah, and I do think that there's a huge difference. And although I would say from the kind of courses I teach and the kind of things that, that students say. I think they are disappointed in Obama. But the kids who actually are, you know, how can I say, familiar with our political system and what's gone on over the past few years are extremely critical of the Republicans for, in their, you know, from their perspective, simply thwarting every effort. So I think, you know, they're not as enthusiastic about Obama, but they're not angry at Obama.
Yeah, and just talking to Aaron Stewart, I mean, you can sort of see that if she's ever going to harden into a doctrinaire Republican, that really hasn't happened. I mean, she's kind of the opposite of a Tea Party Republican, as far as I can tell, anyway.
Yeah, and based on where she represents, you know, many moons ago when I was a young 25-year-old man, as I sit here in my mid-50s, I was a member of the legislature for Mansonia, a very Democratic district. So you can't be as the same kind of Republican that you would be if you were, you know, from Lower Fairfield County.
Right.
All right, we're going to grab a great break here. Thanks. So, Rennie, do you have more time with us, or
I have a meeting soon, but
right.
It depends on how things break for you.
Well, I know you'd love to talk about this poll, and we're going to add Doug Schwartz to the conversation. I'm going to try to keep you here just for a second, and we'll come back after this. And we're back. This is Where We Live. This is The Wheelhouse. John Dankosky is in Washington, D.C. And so just to sort of keep things in balance, President Obama decided to come up to Connecticut. I'm Colin McEnroe. I'm guest hosting for John. With me is Tom Dutchick. He is the editor of CT Capital Report. For about 2 seconds more, we also have Rennie Fulco from Trinity College. I know she's got a meeting that she's running to, but we want to get started anyway with Doug Schwartz, the emperor of the Q poll. The Quinnipiac poll has just come out. So the director, Doug Schwartz, is here. I want to just set this thing up so maybe Rennie has a chance to either ask one question or make one comment. But Doug, this Q poll in the governor's race, it kind of looks a little bit like the Q poll in the governor's race in, you know, like in October of 2010. It's the same two guys,
exactly,
and the numbers are not that different.
It looks like the election results from 2010. If the election were held today, we found that 42% of Connecticut voters would go for Foley and 42% would go for Malloy.
And the big surprise to me, anyway, was the degree to which the other Republican candidates. Now, I mean, granted, they don't the ones who are going to get public financing don't have it yet. They don't have their grants. They can't spend money. They can't do anything really much to call attention to themselves. But the degree to which they're sort of not moving the needle right now was a little bit of a surprise.
We looked at this race back in June, and Foley had 36% of the Republican primary vote, and you're exactly right. We looked at it yesterday, same number. He's far ahead of everyone else with 36%. The next closest was Mark Bowen at 11%.
Rennie Fulco is still here. Rennie, did you either have a question or a comment about the Quinnipiac poll?
Yeah, I was just going to ask. Hi, Doug. I actually saw you last night when I was exercising on television, so I thought you looked wonderful and were as informative as always. I just wonder what you think in terms of how early this is and, you know, how much weight you would give, you know, to the general sense of this poll.
Well, there's still plenty of time for change in so many directions. One thing that, you know, I mentioned yesterday was that Foley has to go through this primary process and may well get bruised by it. So there's still plenty of room for movement. And also in the Republican primary itself, you know, we still have a convention to go through, and then we'll have the field will get settled, and we'll have to see who's actually in it. So there's still plenty of room for change here.
Okay.
All right, listen, I know, Rennie, that you have to get going, so we want to thank you very much for having joined
us
today.
Call again. I love doing the show, and I will, you know, just happy to be able to contribute.
All right, thanks very much. From Trinity College, Rennie Fulco. So Doug Schwartz, one of the few people besides Tom Foley who can take any comfort from this poll is maybe Mark Bowden. At least he's in double digits, right? He's the nearest competitor.
That's right. He's at 11%. No other Republican candidate tops 6%. But Bowen is still pretty far behind at this point. He's 25 points behind Foley.
And Tom Dudzik, there are questions about whether Mark Boughton can hit the mark for public financing, too. I mean, he's much slower than McKinney right now in reaching that level to qualify for the grants.
Yeah, I think even Doug would agree that all polls are, as the cliche goes, snapshots in time. And what may poll in 2 or 3 months after the legislative session's over in 2 months may poll differently now. Obviously, McKinney has a plan. He's staying on track. He's raising his money. I think he's closer to the match than anybody else out there. Boughton went and got a running mate to help with that process, but clearly it's good news for Boughton.
You know, Doug Schwartz, I just want to ask you a little bit about the McKinney numbers. I mean, they're a little bit of a surprise. In fact, they're a big surprise. I mean, he's kind of getting the ham sandwich number, right? A ham sandwich can get about 3%. That's what he's getting. He's the minority leader of the Senate. He's on the fastest track to qualify for public financing from among the challengers. You know, he does have a recognizable name to his own name and his father's name. He's worked hard to position himself, and he's actually fallen back from where you had him in June. Does it make you wonder? I mean, you know, you've got a nice sample size here, but it's also sort of a big field. I'm assuming we, at minimum, apply the margin for error on this one?
Sure. Definitely apply the margin of error. And, you know, I've always, you know, found it interesting that there is this disconnect that, you know, folks in the state legislature are not nearly as well known statewide as, you know, we might think. And even with the McKinney name and, you know, his father being a longtime congressman, it really has not helped in terms of John McKinney getting the name recognition.
We're going to stay on this poll on this field for a few more minutes if you want to call in. 860-275-7266 with either a question or a comment. 860-275-7266. Tom Dudzik, I would sort of recast a little bit what Doug Schwartz just said. I think it's almost inevitably true that members and even leaders of the State General Assembly are not as famous as they think they are.
Oh, no, there's no question about that. I remember when former the Speaker Jim Amon was running for governor as a Democrat in a primary, you know, to when Malloy was running, and he was out there on the hustings out there in North Grosvenordale, and the first thing people would say to him is, "So, son, what do you do in Washington?" They have no idea who these guys are. They're like big fish in a big pond, but when they get out in the state, they're just dwarfed by just you know the everyday life.
You know, Doug Schwartz, as you go deeper into some of the other questions in the poll and looking at crosstabs and stuff like that, do you get a sense of what this 2014 election will be about, what the real themes will be, either in terms of the personalities and leadership styles of the candidates or the issues that underlie the race?
I think that, you know, the key is going to be the economy. That the Republicans are going to attack Malloy on not doing enough to improve Connecticut's economy. The truism about the chief executive is always gets the lion's share of the blame when things are going wrong, fair or unfair. So that's where I see the campaign going.
So, Doug, let me ask you this. If you look at the history of Connecticut politics, every seat right now is pretty much held by Democrats. But historically, the state has chosen Republican chief executives in their governors. They've chosen Roland for a bunch of years. They've chosen Rail. What's the propensity among the voters to go Republican on that level, but basically Democrats basically everywhere else?
Yeah, you're right, Tom. You do see it historically that the right kind of Republican, I guess, who can get enough of the independent vote can win for governor here, but it doesn't happen. You're right when it comes to the state legislature.
And, you know, looking at Tom Foley's numbers there, it didn't seem like, I mean, everybody looks at the independent column there. I mean, obviously, he's got some strength with independents. I don't know if they're breaking as hard for him as, I mean, he absolutely, I mean, just for people who kind of don't follow this, I mean, the ratio usually goes something like 8-7-4, and that's unaffiliated to Democrat to Republican. So the unaffiliateds are the entity that have the power to offset the tremendous numerical registration advantage that Democrats have, if you can get a lot of them. So,
right.
So the question, I mean, really, one of the key questions for Foley or for anybody, any Republican, is how many of those people can you drive into your corner?
Right. I would think that you'd need to at least break into double digits among independents to counter that Democratic advantage to win.
And how much do you think the unfavorables drive voters. And one of my theories is that people don't vote for people, they vote against people. And they go into the voting booth saying, that Dan Malloy, forget that guy. Or that Tom Foley, I don't like Tom Foley. We talked about it a lot in the last cycle where Linda McMahon had incredibly bad unfavorable numbers. And when John McKinney put his press release out late yesterday afternoon, he pointed to Foley's 21% unfavorable rating as a reason why those numbers will go higher and he's unelectable.
Yeah, I mean, definitely there's a point to that, the unfavorables. You know, that's sort of the first step in the voting decision. If people feel like they don't want their incumbent, so then they're ready to look elsewhere. So you definitely would look at that. And, you know, Malloy's disapproval numbers is at 45%. That's pretty high. His numbers aren't terrible. I mean, they're not like some other governors that we poll on, like the Republican governors in Pennsylvania and Florida have much worse numbers or in much worse shape than Malloy. On the other hand, we also poll on governors like Andrew Cuomo in New York, who is has a great job approval number around 60% and seems to be coasting to an easy reelection.
We're talking to Doug Schwartz. He's the director of the Quinnipiac poll. Just to sort of switch gears for one moment, a couple of things. First of all, one of the other things you did look at in the poll is the minimum wage issue, which, of course, is the marquee issue today in New Britain as President Obama shows up for a rally with other governors and supporters of minimum wage. So how did that look?
Broad support in Connecticut for raising the minimum wage. 71% would support raising the minimum wage, and more than 60% tell us that they would want to raise it to $10.10 or more.
And another question that Tom and I have as political junkies, and I think it's been brought up tantalizingly on Tom's site, is we're all very eager to see a poll in the 5th Congressional District. Obviously, that's where the incumbent, Elizabeth Esty, is considered to be the only – although, I mean, I think you can't really write off the 4th, but she's probably the most imperiled incumbent there. How soon are we going to get a poll there?
Yeah. I never say never, but it's not very likely. We pretty much stick to just the statewide polling and the national polls.
And Doug, let me ask you this conspiracy theory here. First of all, there's two thoughts. Number one, what the heck took you 9 months to get back into Connecticut? Did Leahy have you busy polling New York State? You seem like you poll New York every three months. We're waiting 9 months for a poll in Connecticut. And secondly, I have a lot of reporter friends who've received polling calls from you. So do you salt a couple reporters into your call lists to get the word out, Doug?
Reporters, I guess they're just fortunate to be getting the calls.
The only people who still have landlines.
And then on the other one, it's nice to be missed, but we don't discuss our polling schedule simply because we don't want politicians to try to, target their ads or their events to our polls.
Like, for instance,
influence the outcome.
Like, for instance, a visit from the President of the United States when you were in the field and being announced.
Right. I mean, we're not going to say when we're polling.
Yeah. Anybody who thinks that they could get the White House to show up in Connecticut just because there's a Q poll. I mean, the Q poll is really important, but I think President Obama kind of runs on his own clock there. Doug Schwartz, it's great to talk to you. Tom and I are going to spend a little bit more time breaking down this race here, taking some calls here at 860-275-7266. Thanks very much for visiting us, Doug Schwartz, director of the Quinnipiac poll.
Thanks for having me.
All right. So we got some calls come in, and I'm going to take them in a second. Let's just take a moment, Tom, and look at this race. I'll sketch out one scenario for you, and then you give me your scenario. In some ways, if I'm Governor Dan Malloy, I'm not too upset about this poll. Obviously, I'd like to be leading. I'd like to be as an incumbent, not in a 42-42 tie. On the other hand, I'm starting to think I know who my opponent's going to be. I think it's going to be Tom Foley. I know a little bit about how he runs a campaign. And one thing about Foley is he tends not to want to rely on professionals. He likes to make a lot of the decisions himself. I sat down for coffee with Malloy, with Foley for about an hour last week and got that feeling once again that, he's very much sort of this instinctive guy who kind of thinks he knows how he can do this. Yes, it was a very close race 3 years ago, 4 years ago. So I'm a little nervous about that. But I think if I'm Dan Malloy, with the kind of fundraising I'm doing right now and a professional, aggressive campaign staff, that I can probably beat this guy. I'd rather have an edge on him right now, but I don't feel as though I should be necessarily panicking or feeling terrible about this.
Two thoughts. You're right on with all your thinking. Here's one more. It's an incredibly blue state. if this state was anywhere than deep blue, I think the governor would be certainly in for a race. I think they're looking back at their numbers. Listen, these guys are professionals. They've been polling probably for the last 6 months. They know exactly where the governor is. They know exactly where he is. The problem is that everything he's done recently that the cynical people among us would think is being done for political reasons hasn't really moved the needle very, very much. So I think they have to look at that. But they are, I believe, very confident in where they're going. They look at these numbers, they look at the poll, and they go, well, you know, it's late February, or it's early March. We've got a long ways to go.
I want to come back to that, and I want to come back to some tweets we're getting that are relevant to that. But let me grab a call from John in Kensington. Oh, I know which John this is. 860-275-7266. I thought you were more interested in robins than you are in politics these days, John. 860-275-7266, if other people want to be like John and call in. John, go ahead.
I was going to say that probably the cheapest, freest votes that Foley could get is talk about guns. I mean, it brings people out of the woodwork, and it brings people out that really don't care about politics. They're not paying attention. They don't care about Crimea. They don't care about minimum wage. But you mention guns, and they go ballistic. And
as it were.
It doesn't cost a lot of money, and he could do that. He could pick up a lot of votes that way. I think what Malloy ought to do, and it's counterintuitive to most incumbents, I challenge them to a debate on every corner of the state, because I think that, you know, Foley will continue to put his foot in his mouth. I'd have him out there, and I'd debate him to death.
All right. You know, I mean, on this point of guns, Tom Dudzik, you actually posted this very inflammatory piece from some guns and ammo site, sort of come and get them, Dan Malloy, if you want the guns that we didn't actually register. What are you going to do about it? And it was very sort of taunting in its tone.
Taunting, do you think?
I mean, taunting is yeah, that's damning it with faint praise or something like that. And I had a number of reactions to that, including – I sort of wonder, I mean, there are a lot of very responsible, normal gun owners in the state who are not crazy, who are not aggressive, who are not boiling with hatred, who are not interested in some kind of, you know, New England version of Ruby Ridge confrontation with the government. And I just wonder about the degree to which their views are just constantly eclipsed and hijacked with what I bet, I'm just making this number up, but it's 15-20% of gun owners at maximum who think and talk like this, but they get all the publicity.
Well, if you believe what the state police say, over 200,000 people applications came to register their guns. So you look at 200,000 plus a spouse or a son who shoots that are really, really angry about this governor and what he's done. 187,000 state employees, right? You look at CEA's membership, you know, 200 and change or 250,000. So you have a significant chunk of the voting group who will go vote. And I think it's going to make a difference.
But, you know, back to John's point, I mean, this issue plays two different ways. It plays one way in the primary, and it plays another and sort of the convention and everything that goes to securing the Republican nomination. And then it'll play another way in the gubernatorial race. What we do see here, I mean, I'm still a little bit bowled over by John McKinney's numbers, but one way to look at them anyway is that John can't pull from two possible Republican constituencies: gun owners who are really mad at Malloy and happen to be registered Republicans, and independents, as far as that goes, too, in the Q poll, although they matter less in the nomination race, and Tea Party people who just don't buy him. But because John was part of the overall compromise on guns, because he's got a voting record, one of the disadvantages he has in running against Foley is that Tom Foley doesn't ever have to vote about anything. He doesn't, you know, he can carve out his positions as he wants. He's not on record as having pushed a button one way or another. And you wonder if some of that will, in fact, hurt McKinney, especially during the time of trying to secure a nomination.
Well, there's no question about it. And don't forget Mark Boughton also is part of Bloomberg's mayors against guns. So, I mean, I think there's you know, he has that issue as well, although he has kind of nuanced it a little bit better. But there's no question about that. The gun issue in the Republican primary is going to be a big deal maker. I always thought that if the Republicans want to maintain the majority in the state of Connecticut, they need to do a number of things. Number one, no convention. Get rid of the convention. It's a $200,000 waste of money. And then have direct primaries and allow unaffiliateds to vote. You do that, different story.
And one of the odd questions about the convention, too, is, and I think you'd have some direct experience of this, and Michael from Greenwich, hang there, because you got a good question, and I do want to bring it up. You know, as a guy like John McKinney goes in there, he has, theoretically anyway, a structure that he can bring in that, that a guy like Tom Foley can't. In other words, he has legislators who have worked with him for a really long time. He has a lot of time that he's sort of just spent within the political apparatus, the Republican political apparatus, such as it is. I mean, it's not a big apparatus in Connecticut, but he's got that. But you wonder how much, you know, they're willing to stand by his side, because they're all politicians too, going in with their town delegations, going in with delegations from their district. They don't want to force their constituents and the other people who will be in those delegations to do something that they don't want to do just because they know and like John McKinney.
And polls like this kind of reinforce that self-fulfilling prophecy that, well, it's tied. I mean, I only lost by 6,500 last time. It's close now. By September, October, I'll be further ahead. And I think that what I believe in the state of Connecticut is that if you're a Democrat, as long as the Democrats in the state of Connecticut hang in there with this governor and they wait for him to turn this thing around. If they've made that intellectual turn that I like the guy, but how worse could it be with a Republican? Then I think he's in trouble.
We're talking about the race right now, 860-275-7266. 860-275-7266. Let's grab a call from Michael in Greenwich. Hi, Michael.
Hi, how are you?
Just good. Just fine.
So I guess I've heard you talk about and other programs talk about the fact that the governor hasn't formally declared his reelection. And I'm curious as to the impact that would have on his standing in the polls and, you know, whether, you know, it would boost or harm him if he formally declared and what impact that has on his sort of treading water stance with Foley.
I think it's a great question. I'll let Tom tackle it first.
Well, yeah, I mean, I've kicked around that whole issue of announcing, not announcing. Listen, everyone knows he's going to run, you know. And if I were a Republican out there, I'd say, well, the reason why he's not saying he's not going to run, because if the state was in as bad a shape as it is, I wouldn't want to announce that I'm running either. The flip side is that he gets to play the I am not a politician card. And I am going to sit here and I'm going to fight for the people of the state of Connecticut. I am going to do what's right. And let these politicians do their things. When I'm ready, we'll make a decision. And that's a pretty powerful argument.
You know, one little subplot to this, and I don't think it's a significant subplot, but as you may know, there's a Republican from Newington who actually filed a complaint with the State Elections Enforcement Commission saying, well, there really is a campaign running right now. There's a campaign for Malloy running right now, and he's essentially violating the law if he doesn't acknowledge that. I don't think it's going to get very far, particularly because the SEC isn't quite as independent as it used to be. But I mean, if Michael's wondering about that, I mean, a certain kind of Republican, and it's the kind of thing I'm surprised that Foley hasn't jumped on it harder, because it's the kind of thing he likes to talk about anyway. It's a storyline that Tom Foley likes, which is these people don't do anything out in the open.
But I also think that when you look at missed opportunities, I think Tom Foley missed a lot of opportunities when it came to the last scandal that rocked the state capitol. You know, if you're going to make your campaign based on ethics or the inability for politicians to be ethical, then I think you have to be front and center when scandals happen. And you have to say, well, if it's a Republican scandal, I'm the outsider. There's enough to blame to go on both sides of the aisle. I'm here to clean it up. It's not going to happen under me.
Yeah. You know, in my conversation with him last week, I mean, it was just a cup of coffee at the same, but he seemed prepared to go that route. I mean, he hasn't publicly claimed that high ground right now, but I wouldn't be surprised to see him be willing to do that. But as you say, there was a moment to do it, and he let it pass. One quick thing. We got a couple of calls here, and then we got a little sort of surprise topic towards the end of the show here today. But one quick thing that needs to be acknowledged is, and I think it will ultimately affect Tom Foley's chances going through the convention into the primary. There are a substantial number of Republicans. I don't know how many, and probably Doug Schwartz is not going to find out for us, but a substantial number of Republicans who really still do believe that they won the election in 2010. You know, that in fact something weird happened in Bridgeport. I mean, I'm going to be Dutchick now with conspiracy theories, but there are a lot of them that do subscribe to that conspiracy theory. They think they won. They think Foley conceded too early. And you have to think that that might give Foley a pretty good chance, in the sense that there may be a lot of Republicans anyway who think, wow, you know, you should be governor right now.
I think if you talk to insiders on the Democratic Party, I think they would say that not so much Bridgeport, but the plurality in New Haven pushed them over the top, not Bridgeport. And any impropriety in voting in Bridgeport would be, you know, is not really the issue. What's going to be interesting this time around is if you look at the Harp election and you look at those 9,000 people that voted for Justin Elliker, the Elliker vote is not a Malloy vote. it's kind of an anti-government, anti-establishment, anti-party kind of vote. They didn't want that party machine. They wanted a more clean election. They wanted a more clean candidate. And so they voted for Elicker. So 9,000 votes in New Haven's a lot.
But I can't see Foley getting those votes. I could see McKinney maybe getting some of those votes. Tom Foley, even though he's trying to position himself as a clean government, good government kind of guy, I don't see an Elicker voter. We're talking about basically about New Haven, liberal, post-college, hipster, you know. I mean, I don't see those votes going there.
Yeah, right, right. But what my point was that the governor, they may stay home, Colin. Mm-hmm. So I think what the governor has to do is he has to try to woo those voters. And, you know, and again, if you look at conspiracy theories, you know, I mean, here's a governor who went overboard on the whole genetically modified organism thing. Usually governors GMOs are not on the top of their hip parade. But he's putting together constituencies that will vote for him to make up this vote. He was very public about Scuppy the horse, Colin. Scuppy the horse. Governors are not worried about Scuppy the horse, but 30,000 to 40,000.
You might want to explain who Scuppy the horse.
Scuppy the horse. She bit someone down there in Milford, and went all the way to the state court. And so now the problem is that if horses are classified as vicious, there's going to be a big hit to the state of Connecticut's economy because 40,000 to 50,000. Horses are out there, and it's a big part of the agricultural economy in our state. Having said that, I don't look at the horses. I look at the horse owners.
Yeah.
And so I think that's where we're going. We're putting together constituencies who are going to vote for this governor no matter what.
Yeah.
Single-issue politics.
There are rumors that Scuppy will be on the podium today with President Obama, and we cannot confirm them or deny them.
I just like saying the word Scuppy the horse.
Yeah, I know you do. I can tell. Here's Sarah from New Britain. Hi, Sarah.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Are you stuck in traffic yet because of the motorcades, or I guess that hasn't happened for a while?
Not yet. I'm trying to get there, actually. I was wondering, I was at your teacher panel last week. I'm wondering if you see Malloy losing any teacher votes due to all his education reform that teachers are just so unhappy about.
I think it's a great question. I think we both know the answer, but I'll let Tom give it.
Oh, boy. Yeah. There's rumors floating around the state of Connecticut that are rampant that the CEA, Connecticut Education Association, the largest teachers organization in the state, is even looking at a Republican in John McKinney. So I think that gives you an idea of how bitter the battles have been. And you know, that's a significant amount of people out there, both retired and active teachers, who do not want to vote for this governor.
It absolutely is a political problem for Malloy. Now, one of the ways it's less of a political problem, I think, is that at least for the moment, is that Governor Malloy's education policies are essentially Republican education policies. In other words, it's hard for a Republican to position himself in a way that's substantially different from Stephen Pryorism, right? I mean, it's hard for me. I mean, McKinney basically has tried to do that, suffer the poor teachers to come unto me. But it's not an easy fit, really. I mean, Malloy kind of grabbed what usually is their position.
Right, and I think you hit the nail on the head that the Stephen Pryor is the holy grail, and I think a lot of the teachers would want to see him gone, and I don't think the governor's going to go that way.
All right, we've got to take a break here. I'm really sorry, Thomas. You've actually Thomas from Storage, you've got a great question if we had time, but we don't have time. We're going to come back with a little conversation about a bill that's making its way through the General Assembly, or might make its way through the General Assembly, about noise in movie theaters. And we're back. This is Where We Live. It's The Wheelhouse. John Dankosky is in Washington, D.C. right now. President Obama is coming to New Britain, so everything kind of balances out reasonably well. Two of the greatest men in American history are just swapping places for one day. I'm Colin McEnroe. I'm guest hosting The Wheelhouse. Tom Dudzik from CT Capital Reports in studio with me. Towards the end of these shows, we often have to, like to sort of head off the political tracks a little bit and investigate an issue that has more to do with quality of life and how we live our lives. So there is a bill in the legislature. Who knows how far it would go? It proposes a maximum decibel level for movies.
What?
Yes,
huh?
Exactly.
Huh?
Films would not be allowed to exceed 85 decibels. Now, I happen to know somebody who knows more about movie sound than just about any human being alive, and that is James Hanley from Trinity Cine Studio. He joins us right now. James, I don't know how aware you were of this bill, but I'd love to know what you think about it.
Well, I just heard about it yesterday, actually. I didn't know about it in advance, but I don't know. My first take on it is that it would be an extraordinarily difficult thing to enforce, and I'm not sure that would really be something that you know, you that would be any kind of a solution if indeed there is really a serious problem. For most people, I think the most serious problem really is trailers. That's where people get upset, because the trailers actually come through with a louder soundtrack, and unless you monitor that, which at Cine Studio we do, and we reduce the level because of that, the problem is that the people who make trailers are trying to get your attention, and they don't like people talking and eating through the trailers, so they jack up the volume. And a few years ago, this reached a peak when I think more powerful sound systems were coming in, and for a while the trailer volume was held down lower, but then it sort of came back, and now we drop the level of trailers that we show by almost a full point on the Dolby scale of 1 to 10, and it brings it into a sort of normal level, but it's not quite as simple as that, even for sort of regular films, in that sound is composed of sort of regular continuing sound like dialogue and so on, and peaks, sort of like if you went to any other event, like an orchestral concert or even a solo concert, for example. And so to say, okay, 85 decibels, this is going to be the level, and sort of monitor it and actually enforce it, I think it's an extraordinarily difficult task to do that.
And that's where the FCC got in with television. So they've monitored the levels of TV programming, so if advertisers don't jack the commercial, but they did use that loophole of the highest decibel that you use during the course of your programming is where you can set it. So they set it high. But, you know, you talk about movie trailers. Let's have a flashback, a Mac flashback to 2005, where State Rep Andrew Fleshman, right, from West Hartford, he proposed legislation to force movie listings to print the time that previews start and when the movie starts. Right. And his quote was, "We are being robbed of our freedom, Colin McEnroe, because we're not told when the actual movie begins."
Right.
The legislators love these movies, huh?
Yeah.
I don't know. Yeah, it seems an attractive thing to do something like this. And if you operate a movie theater, you know that, you know, the practicalities are quite complex. Just as another sort of wrinkle to this, a theater like Cine Studio, which has masonry walls 4 or 5 foot thick, nothing moves. And so we have a reverberated sound system, which is very different from a sound system in a theater, which is built of much lighter building materials. And the way that sound is perceived in those spaces is different.
Well, you know, it's funny. It's funny that we're having this conversation, James, because usually when you and I are talking, we're talking about the opposite thing, which is that at multiplexes, they often can't turn the sound up high enough to realize the design, the filmmaker's design of the sound, because there'll be too much of a bleed through wall to wall.
Exactly. I was about to mention that again. That's another sort of wrinkle in this whole thing, because modern building materials, it's very, very hard to insulate completely between the theaters, and when you have discrete digital soundtracks that are capable of producing low frequencies, for example, at much more insistent levels than was possible in the past, those are virtually impossible to insulate against. So even, you know, if you're watching, I don't know, the Met Opera in one theater, and then next door there's an extremely low frequency spacecraft going by, you're going to feel the rumble, no question.
All right, James Hanley from Trinity Cine Studio. By the way, go there and experience their fabulous sound system. It's the best you'll ever hear. Thanks very much for your time. Thanks to Tom Dudzik from CT Capital Report. Thanks to everybody from where we live for putting up with me for a day. We'll be back at 1 o'clock, the Colin McEnroe Show. We'll kind of extend this a little bit. We're doing a show about minimum wage. We'll have people on who have tried to live on minimum wage. We'll have economists who look at its net impact. So join us at 1 p.m. for that. We'll also have coverage of President Obama's visit throughout the day. So as we head into the afternoon, all things considered, you'll hear some of our reporters covering the New Britain event.